On Tech News Today, we've got 6 interviews lined up with brilliant reporters from The Wall Street Journal, Fortune, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, TechCrunch, Advertising Age, and Apple Insider. Stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, May 19th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news of the journalists who report it, and we've got lots of journalists who reported today. My name is Mike Elgin. Welcome to the show. Our co-anchor today is After Nine's content czar, Joe Panettiere. What's up, Joe?
Nothing much, Mike. How you been?
I've been great. You know, there's just a new study just came across my feed here that says 70% of people text while driving or use their phones while driving. That is way too many. Are you one of those people,
what,
Joe?
What would be a good number for you, Mike?
Zero?
Yeah, exactly. No, so I got to concede. I used to be one of those texter while driving guys, but I've got 3 sons, 16, 14, 9. And one day my wife and I looked at each other and we said, we got to set a better example, but B, take care of ourselves and those around us. So, yeah, basically we have a rule in the car. The smartphone goes into the glove compartment when we're driving.
Nice. That's a good one. That also will protect you from if you get into a minor bumper cruncher from that smartphone clocking you in the head, which is always a good thing as well. So, well, anyway, good. I'm glad to know that you're in the sensible minority, and hopefully a lot more people will stop texting while driving. That's a very, very bad idea. Well, we got a lot of really great stories today and a lot of really great interviews lined up. So why don't we jump into it? Our top story today. Remember those rumors about Apple's big screen TV set from a year or two ago? Well, turns out they were almost true. Apple actually planned to build a TV, but those plans were scrapped a year ago, according to the Wall Street Journal. But there's still hope for those of us who actually want a TV set made by Apple. Mikey Campbell is the editor of Apple Insider and joins us now. Welcome to you, Mikey.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
It's going great now. Why is there hope? Does anybody think Apple will actually resurrect its TV set plans?
I know one analyst who very much does hope that Apple does do that. Gene Munster, who's been probably the main cheerleader for an Apple television set over the past decade.
Hey, Mikey, what about what Apple may or may not have been planning to put into this TV set in terms of hardware and software? Any clues to the features and functions they were thinking about?
Well, according to the Wall Street Journal article, they were thinking about adding in a lot of advanced sensors and cameras. So it was kind of an allusion towards something like the Microsoft Kinect system. From what we understand, they wanted to build in advanced video conferencing features, what they call FaceTime for the television. It's kind of the thing that we've seen from other smart TVs out on the market already. I believe Samsung and LG both have sets that offer similar capabilities. But what Apple was going to do, we don't know for sure. They would have obviously put their own flavor on it.
Now, The Worldwide Developers Conference is coming up next month, and the sort of cryptic logo that they always have for all of their announcements and conferences suggests something in the middle of a whole bunch of other things. And the word on the street is that what's in the middle is an Apple TV, and what's all around is all your other expensive Apple products. In other words, that the Apple TV will be converted into a hub within your home for all this other stuff. Does that sound like a reasonable possibility? And what do you know or what do you expect Apple to announce around the Apple TV at their Worldwide Developers Conference?
Well, actually, that is a really good theory, one that's been kicking around for a few months now. As far as Apple TV as a hub, the technology is definitely there. We know that the device itself is ripe for a upgrade. Apple's been doing a lot of work in interconnectivity, especially we were talking about the Apple Watch before the show. You know, it's got handoff. So Apple could foreseeably build some of that into a new Apple TV model and announce it at WWDC. And I guess it could be based on their HomeKit platform, which is their Internet of Things. You know, it's their initiative in that area. So I could definitely see something like that happening.
Hey, Mikey, so what we're talking about right now is the actual Apple TV, call it the set-top box or video streaming box, so to speak, right? Not a big screen TV per se.
No.
So back to that sort of big screen digital hub next generation conversation. Do you think Apple is just scared about skating to or trying to figure out where to skate to, where the puck is going to be? Because TV is changing so quickly. I mean, many would argue that "quote unquote" TV is dead. You know, the actual endpoints, the flat screen TVs, the margins have come way down. Over the air and cable broadcast, that's all being disrupted. You know, do you think Apple is just afraid of? We can't figure out where this is all going.
I don't think they're afraid so much as the technology right now. They can't really see a way to enter that market without. Or with a true innovation or a truly innovative product, like they did with a smartphone, iPhone, tablet, iPad, and now the watch, which is, you know, of course, Apple Watch. Like the Wall Street Journal said, executives were looking at the ideas and the prototypes for this ultra high definition television set, and they just couldn't see any substantial gain that the consumer would have, you know, versus say a Sony or a Panasonic.
Interesting. Very interesting. And I can't wait to watch this show on the future Apple TV or the future TV set from Apple. Either one. It's an awesome show. We're already, a lot of people already watch us on Apple TV. And it's really interesting to see that Apple TV, the whole TV space, the whole living room experience is something that Apple has been sort of almost on the sidelines with. I mean, hardly anybody has an Apple TV compared to all the other options out there, you know, especially when you compare it to Apple's dominance in markets like smartphones and so on. Mikey Campbell is at appleinsider.com. You can follow him on Twitter at MikeyCampbell81. Thanks for joining us today, Mikey.
Thanks a lot, guys. Have a good one.
All right. More news in a sec, but first let's talk about Braintree, one of our sponsors today. If you're a mobile app developer, you got to check out Braintree. And if you're a person who likes to use a lot of the services that we talk about on this show, services like Uber, Airbnb, I'm a huge fan and customer of Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, Munchery, these are all really great newish companies that got super successful very fast. And one of the secrets of their success was using Braintree. Braintree scaled these companies up from an early stage startups and grew with them, and they continue to benefit from the implementation of Braintree for payment. With Braintree, you can accept Apple Pay, you can accept PayPal, you can accept all kinds of credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover, Diners Club, and a lot more. And of course, they have excellent customer service and super, super simple integration. Talk to somebody who's implemented Braintree and they will tell you it's really easy. And of course, they have payouts that are very, very fast. Braintree gives you a full stack payment solution, support for all payment types for your customers. And you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, and so much more with a single integration across all platforms. They also have superior fraud protection, customer service, and really fast payouts. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/TNT. Well, Google won an important case for free speech yesterday. A California appeals court struck down an order for Google to ban a 14-minute film called Innocence of Muslims. Remember that? It was a trailer for that film posted on YouTube, triggered a wave of protests starting in September of 2012 in Cairo, which then spread to other predominantly Muslim countries. The protests and riots caused multiple deaths across the Middle East, Africa, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, although it's not clear that any of the protesters ever saw the trailer. In any event, Jeff John Roberts writes for Fortune and is here to talk about this recent court case. Welcome to you, Jeff John Roberts.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
Now, the order to remove the video was not based on its alleged offensiveness to Muslims, was it? How did this whole thing end up in court in the first place?
Yeah, this whole thing was terrible from start to finish. I mean, the so-called movie was just a provocation. It was just a 14-minute amateur clip intended to provoke the Muslim world. But then it got worse when the poor actress, who was sort of duped to appear in the first place, wanted to get rid of it because she kept getting these death threats. Unfortunately, legally, she didn't really have a leg to stand on, so she went the copyright route, which is always sort of bad news when you try to take copyright or intellectual property and cram it into a use it wasn't supposed to. And amazingly, a California judge actually bought this and said, you have a performance in your, you have a copyright in your performance, and you can ask YouTube to take it down, and worse, order YouTube to forbid it from appearing again. So a lot of people freaked out, understandably.
So, Jeff, what was the First Amendment argument here for not forcing Google to ban this video from the way you're reading it so far?
Well, I mean, pick an argument. She had nothing to stand on for copyright reasons. One, it's a major news event. I mean, you know, people have a right to see it and talk about it. But worse, I mean, she didn't have a copyright in it. I mean, you guys might have a copyright in this Tech News Today podcast, but I can't pop up and say I have a copyright in what I'm saying right now. I mean, it's your show, not mine. And for Hollywood or for the media industry generally, it would be a disaster if everyone who appears in any movie or TV show can suddenly claim they have a copyright in it. That's just not the law. But I think the original judge felt sorry for this woman and so was just basically trying to do her a favor. I can't get into his mind, but no copyright scholar could believe this when he ruled that.
The weird thing is that there's a Streisand effect in place here. I mean, you mentioned and characterized this as a provocation. Clearly, that's what it was. It was intended to offend some Muslims. And there are thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of such provocations against Muslims, against Christians, against everybody, somewhere, everywhere, especially on YouTube. There's lots of offensive speech or stated another way, lots of the stuff on YouTube is offensive to someone in some way. And the fact that this case has been singled out and brought to the forefront and caused so much trouble is the result of a whole bunch of random events that include a lot of opportunism on the part of people who are deliberately trying to stir up protests and so on in the Middle East. So I completely agree with you and this judge on this ruling, and I'm kind of freaked out that about the original verdict. It's scary that the ban was ruled in the first place. Do you think we need to clarify copyright law or clarify something to make sure that in the future something like this won't allow a judge to feel sorry for a woman and then just set a precedent over copyright law?
Well, I think the ruling yesterday, which totally overruled the first judge, sort of took care of that particular issue. But I mean, we've seen it time and again where copyright is just sort of a backdoor for censorship. You know, you don't like a picture, you don't like this, you don't like that. Normally under free speech, you can't attack it, but you can say you have a copyright and try to bring it down. And you know, we've seen all sorts of actors try and do this. Fortunately, people are starting to become more aware of the danger this poses, but it's something I think we also have to be sort of vigilant about. This was just one of the most egregious examples anyone had ever seen. I mean, you don't have to like the video, but there's absolutely no doubt that this was sort of a free speech situation, and more importantly, that this woman had utterly no copyright in the video. So to ask to take it down from YouTube in the first place, and even worse, order YouTube to proactively ban anyone else from posting it was really outrageous.
Now, Jeff, this is the first time you've been on the show as a Fortune writer. You previously were at GigOM, of course. How do you like writing for Fortune?
It's my second day, but so far it's great. We've got a lot of really sharp people. I've got some of my old GigOM colleagues here, and we've got a bigger platform and sort of a team really looking to bust out and develop some groundbreaking tech coverage. So it'll be good to be here.
Yeah, Fortune snapped up half dozen of some of the best GigOM writers. Really great move on their part. And congratulations to you. Jeff John Roberts is at Fortune.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Jeff John Roberts. Thanks for joining us today, Jeff.
Thanks, Mike. Have a good one.
You too. Well, the Electronic Frontier Foundation and many other organizations around the world are coming out to publicly oppose Facebook's internet.org and how it tries to bridge the digital divide. The EFF's piece was written by two Jeremys, Jeremy Galula and Jeremy Malcolm, and it's Jeremy Malcolm who joins us now. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Now, internet.org is trying to bring free internet access to people who can't afford it. What's wrong with that?
Well, actually, we are totally in favor of that. And we think the idea of bridging the digital divide and bringing the internet to the two-thirds of the world who don't already have it is a fantastic idea. Our problem is with the way that Facebook has approached this. And they've decided they need to be really the gatekeeper of the internet and rate websites that are submitted to them according to the criteria that they set. And that's where we have a whole range of problems that that introduces. Firstly, it means that Facebook and its partners are able to be pressured by third parties. As in the previous interview, the copyright lobby, for example, rather than going to the courts to have sites taken down off internet.org, they'll just have to go to Facebook and say, hey, Facebook, just take this down. So it really expands the opportunities for censorship. The other thing that this does is, for technical reasons, it makes it impossible for sites to be transmitted securely. With the exception of the Android app, users of other platforms will have to access the web without SSL encryption. And that's dangerous when people can be snooped on for political reasons or for persecution of gays, for persecution of minorities. So particularly in some of these poor countries where there are oppressive governments or authoritarian governments, we think it's important to be able to encrypt the internet. And the way this product works at the moment, that's not going to be possible.
Hey, Jeremy, has Facebook said or documented anything about how they decide what's going to get through the pipe and what isn't going to get through the pipe? And also, is this a manual process over at Facebook? I assume it isn't. It sounds like maybe there's a proxy server involved, et cetera.
Yeah, there is a proxy server involved, but submitting your site to be included is actually a manual process. There are a set of criteria that you have to satisfy, including your site shouldn't rely on JavaScript, it shouldn't have embedded fonts, it shouldn't have videos, shouldn't have images that are larger than 1 megabyte in size, shouldn't have VoIP. There's a whole lot of really onerous criteria for today's modern web 3.0 or whatever we're up to. I've lost count. So we can understand the reason for that. It's because in many of these developing countries, people don't have high bandwidth. They don't have phones like iPhones or Android phones. They may have simpler feature phones. And so Facebook wants to ensure that the websites are accessible on those phones. And that's totally legitimate. We think that that's a great idea. But filtering out the rest of the internet and making it so that Facebook and its partners have to approve these sites is a problem. I think if there was an automated way of filtering out content that was too high bandwidth and that you could otherwise access the entire internet, we would probably have less of a problem with that. If there was no gatekeeper role as such, if it was just an automated system and if it would present, 90% of the internet and just filter out really high bandwidth stuff, I think that would probably be a good step towards fixing this internet.org platform.
Now, there's a question about internet.org. We've brought it up a couple of times on the show, especially in the context of the opposition in India by people who believe that internet.org is a violation of net neutrality. And that is, what is internet.org organizationally? Is this, it's presented to us as a kind of nonprofit that's backed by by Facebook. Is this actually part of Facebook? Is Facebook completely in control of it? What's your sense of internet.org's dependence or independence on Facebook?
Well, Facebook did initiate this project. They since brought on a range of partners, including telecommunications operators, the equipment manufacturers. And the aim of the project as such is, my reading of it is that it's potentially broader than this specific proxy project that's accessible through mobile handsets. I think if you look at their mission statement, it's actually potentially a broader way of bringing the internet to the other two-thirds of the world's population. So the problems that we have with the way this is being done, I don't think they count against what Facebook's trying to accomplish through its partners. I think it's really just saying, hey, go back to the drawing board, see if you can do this in a slightly different way that's not going to have these bad effects. For example, I used to live in a developing country, and the mobile provider that I used gave free access to the entire internet, but it was rate limited. So this applied even to the basic level mobile subscriptions, even the pay-as-you-go subscriptions where you may only pay a few dollars a month. You still had a basic level of access to the entire internet. The only problem was it was limited to a low speed. So something like that, if Facebook could accomplish something like that on a global level, that would be brilliant. I think we would have no quibble with that.
Hey, Jeremy, have Facebook and or internet.org responded to your thoughts or responded to any of the pushback that they've been hearing?
Well, we did have a private conversation with them before we published our blog post. So we gave them some warning of what we were going to say, and we wanted to hear from them. For one thing, we wanted to make sure that what we were writing was technically accurate. And that was a really useful conversation. I can't divulge everything that was said, but I think I can say that this is not some evil scheme that some people have speculated, where Facebook is really just trying to mine data and you know, to track people across the web and sell advertising to them. That's not what Facebook is trying to do with internet.org. We think they do have good motives. But at the same time, they realize as much as anyone else that there are some really hard technical problems if you're going to try and do the project this way. If you're going to try and be a gatekeeper for the internet, if you're going to try and have a whitelist of sites and serve them all out through your proxy server, that introduces some really hard problems. And they have some of the most brilliant engineers in the world, and they haven't been able to crack this. So maybe that's a sign that actually you need to go back and rethink the whole thing.
Well, I can't wait for the solar-powered drones myself. Jeremy Malcolm and other Jeremys are available at EFF.org. And you can follow him on Twitter at QIRTAIBA. Thanks for joining us today, Jeremy.
Thank you very much. All right. See you later.
Silicon Valley is funding better farming. Google led a $15 million round of investment in an organization called Farmers Business Network. Other investors include Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers and others. Christine McGee is the editor for Crunchbase and wrote about the story for TechCrunch. Welcome to you, Christine.
Hey, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. Now, what is Farmers Business Network and what the heck did they do?
So Farmers Business Network, they're calling it a farmer-to-farmer network. I mean, essentially what they do is collect data from farmers all over the country and then use that data to help these farmers make smarter business decisions. So whether that's the seed they're buying or how much they're buying, they're using crops or plants per acre, those are decisions that farmers have to make every year. And so if they can be super precise about all of this stuff, they can save. Farmers have very small margins. So it's kind of important.
So in terms of what the investment money will be used for, any clues as to how Farmers Business Network will use this money?
Yeah, essentially, I think what they're using it for is just scaling and building out this network, right? So they've already partnered. They wouldn't tell me how many farms they've already signed up, but they are collecting data from, 7 million acres in the U.S. in 17 states, I think. So they're going to be adding more and more farmers to the platform, which in turn makes the database more valuable, right? Because the more data that you have, the better insights you can gain from that.
Now, one of the things that that I constantly obsess on, and we were talking about this just a second ago when we took a short break here, is that you can use like technology to create like really unhealthy artificial food, or you can use technology to make better food and make more of it in a way that doesn't actually degrade the quality of the food. And in this case, they're talking about using big data techniques to understand, to plug in all this data about weather and soil quality and the types of seeds that are used so that farmers can understand without all the trial and error that farming normally involves, right off the bat, what's likely to succeed in their area? What works in the area, like, for example, in California, where there's, you know, severe drought? What works in this kind of environment? What works during a drought? What do you do when the drought is over? That sort of thing. And this is really fascinating technology. Is this a core focus of Farmers Business Network, or is this just a side business for them?
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's something they're focused on, and that's something that Google Ventures is focused on, too. They led the round. And I think everyone's saying now that information is really this next big era of agriculture, and it's this idea of sharing that we've already seen in other parts of tech, right, with open source everything, is now kind of being applied to agriculture. So if you share all this information and pool all of this data, everyone can be a lot more efficient. And it's very relevant right now with the drought and the statistics. If you look at how much food we need to be producing to keep up with population demand, it's super cool, I think.
Yeah, Christine, are there any clues so far as to how Farmer Business Network will filter and or present this information? Because even before a network like this starts, the farmers are overloaded with data at this point. And I'm just wondering if there's any type of clue in terms of just how much more information Farmers Business Network will pump back to the farmers.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know they're collecting data from, Charles was telling me, 35 different software platforms. So the way I understand that, which my knowledge about modern farming is very slim, so don't take my word for any of this necessarily, but I guess you have sensors on all of this farming equipment, right? So whether it's the planter or the tractor or everything, really, from planting to harvest. So if you access all of that data, all farmers have to do now is upload the files that the software is already generating onto the FBN platform. And I think their goal is to continue adding more and more features so that farmers can use this type of analytics on all of the things going on the farm. I'm not sure exactly what they're able to look at now. I have not used the platform, so I couldn't tell you.
Now, Christine, very quickly, I think everybody's familiar with TechCrunch. Can you tell us what Crunchbase is all about?
Yeah, of course. Crunchbase is a database of tech companies, founders, investors, venture deals, really all investment data, and it's crowdsourced. So anyone can create a Crunchbase profile and keep it up to date, and that's kind of how we ensure that we're catching information from venture firms or other parts of the community. All that stuff is not necessarily public, so we try and do our best of capturing all of that. It's cool. You should check it out if you haven't.
I have certainly checked it out. I just want to make sure that everybody knows what it is that you do, and it's a really interesting resource. And, of course, that is obviously owned and sort of associated with TechCrunch itself. Christine McGee is at crunchbase.com, techcrunch.com, and also on Twitter at C_McGee27. Thank you so much for joining us today, Christine.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Take care.
All right. Well, after dumping music CDs, Starbucks has teamed up with streaming music leader Spotify to provide music in the chain's thousands of restaurants. Julie Jargon specializes in the restaurant industry for The Wall Street Journal and joins us to talk about it. Welcome to you, Julie.
Hi, thanks for having me, Mike.
Thanks for being on. Now, is there a benefit for existing subscribers of Spotify in all this? For example, what are star points?
Star points are basically rewards points that Starbucks gives to its loyal customers. So every time you buy a cup of coffee, if you have an account with Starbucks for rewards, you earn stars. And after earning so many of those stars, you can go in and redeem them for a free cup of coffee at Starbucks. So what they're doing now for Spotify customers, people who sign up for premium Spotify accounts, those people will get a certain number of Starbucks stars just for joining Spotify, and they can then use those when they go to Starbucks.
Hey, Julie, tell me a little bit about the actual music in the Starbucks retail locations. I mean, are we suddenly going to have customized music pumped in from Spotify based on this relationship? And will it change from person to person? I mean, I may have horrendous taste walking in the door. And is Mike going to be subjected to that terrible music as I walk in and Starbucks tries to welcome me?
Right. Actually, what they're trying to do is essentially going to make baristas DJs. So what's going to happen is the 150,000 Starbucks baristas in the United States will get Spotify accounts, and they will then be able to create playlists for their stores. So the music you hear from store to store will differ depending on the tastes of not only the baristas, but of the customers. The customers using their Spotify or Starbucks app will be able to give some input into the music selection. They can say whether they like the songs that are being played. They can suggest other songs they want to have played. There will be a software algorithm that will kind of compute the input that's coming in from the customers. And apparently the most popular songs will be played. Songs that customers in large numbers don't like will probably be removed from the playlists. There will be some subjectivity to it, but essentially each Starbucks location will basically serve as a music station.
Really interesting. Starbucks has in the past partnered with a whole lot of companies on media and content, including HP, a whole bunch of other companies. And I guess this is the latest example. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says that they're working on similar deals with other companies for the future. Do you know what or which companies he has in mind?
He hasn't stated what those will be or what kinds of companies those will be, but it's part of their plan to leverage their Starbucks stars and use those as a source of revenue generation. So other companies like, you know, in this instance, Spotify, can purchase the stars from Starbucks. It's basically the right to license or use those stars and use those as an incentive to attract new customers or retain existing customers for other companies. And then Starbucks hopes that that will drive increased traffic to Starbucks cafes where people will come in and redeem those stars for a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it seems like there's going to be a huge intention here for Starbucks customers to discover Spotify, for Spotify users to discover and become loyalty card holders for Starbucks and so on. So we'll see if they succeed with all of that and see what else they announce, what other partnerships they announce going forward. Julie Jargon is at WSJ.com. That's the Wall Street Journal's website. And you can follow her on Twitter at Julie Jargon. Thanks for joining us today, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
Google has been fighting a secret war against fraudulent advertising for years. Alex Kantrowicz wrote a long-form feature about it for Advertising Age, where he's a staff writer, and he joins us now. Welcome to you, Alex.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Thanks for being on again. Now, why is Google's anti-fraud team so secretive?
I think the bottom line is that they have to worry about tipping off the fraudsters that are trying to steal money from them to the ways that they actually find them. So if you read the story that I wrote, you'll see that Google was able to reveal a few different ways that they actually find these fraudsters, but they got pretty cautious about giving away the full game. And so we had to sort of figure out a way to get the story out there without blowing up the operation.
Hey, Alex, any clues as to how big that operation is? How many people at Google are involved and how long they've been working on this?
It's over 100 people, and they've been working on it for a long time because they had to deal with click fraud for a while. But how long has their display anti-fraud group, because that's really where the botnets come in, and those are legions of computers, infected computers that browse the internet trying to simulate human behavior so that advertisers will end up paying for those visitors. So it's hard to tell how long that operation's been around, probably for a while, but it kicked up last year when Google acquired a company called Spider.io and some of the members I met while I was over there.
Now, you had some interesting data in there about the size of Google's advertising operation. Now, we normally hear about advertising in terms of revenue and things like that or market share, but you had some interesting numbers about impressions, which is the number of times an ad is actually loaded from the server into a browser or an app. So in terms of impressions, how does Google compare with the competition?
Just far and above anything else that actually exists in the ad technology space. I think there are about maybe three or four times the size of their next closest competitor, OpenX. And they really were able to do this because they have the leading ad servers on both the publisher and the advertiser end. And once you hook in with the ad server, then the rest of the ad tech business is sort of yours to take.
Hey, Alex, what about your Ad Age site itself? Did Google take a look at that and any types of clues as to what they found there?
That's sort of funny. So just as we began dissecting this stuff, I sit down there next to an engineer and I'm asked to go to adage.com. So I go to adage.com just like I do pretty much every day. And next thing you know, they tell me that my computer is infected. So I thought, oh, okay, now not only am I going to get the story, but it comes with the price. I'm going to destroy AdAge's reputation. But it turns out that it actually, my computer was hacked via a corrupt connection. And it can, your computer can actually get infected with bot software via a number of methods. You can have a bad connection. You can visit a website that's hacked. You can see an ad that has an exploit in it, which is what opens up the computer. So there are any number of different methods that a fraudster can use to gain access to your machine. And so by hacking the connection that I was on, the Google team made it look like AdAge was hacked, but really it was just the connection. So everybody can come visit the site and read my story with no problem, I promise.
Well, your story certainly made me paranoid and freaked out about the possibility of what's installed on my system. So thanks for that. Alex Kantrowitz is at AdAge.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Kantrowitz with a K. Thank you so much for joining us today, Alex.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
All right. Deezer now supports podcasts. The subscription music service added more than 20,000 podcasts to the platform. The podcasts, including Tech News Today, of course, come from Stitcher, which Deezer acquired last year. Deezer podcasts are available right now in France, the UK, and Sweden, and will be rolling out to other countries in a few months. In other product update news, Twitter updated its desktop search feature. The new search had been in test mode since April. Twitter Search now offers a cleaner look, a new tab filtering options, including a live option that lets you click to view new tweets that match your criteria as they happen. I don't know if you've checked it out, Joe Panettiere. I spent a few minutes with the new search today, and it's really, really nice. I like it a lot, especially if you go into more options and go into the advanced search. There's all kinds of really detailed, you know, you can search for very detailed criteria and then say, but only in this area. I mean, you can really get fine, granular control of your searches.
Finally get granular. That's the key point, Mike. I mean, search has been the Achilles heel as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, it's ironic. It gets back to the pharma story we did. We're all overwhelmed with this data, no matter what vertical market we're in. And we're all hoping to search it more effectively. And I think Twitter's on to something here.
They absolutely are. And of course, Facebook, now it's your turn to actually have good search someday. Well, the news you could lose. Chicken giant KFC has upgraded some of their tray liners. You know, those sheets of paper they put on their plastic trays. The new and improved liner is called the Tray Typer. Yeah, you guessed it. The liner has a Bluetooth keyboard built in. Sadly, they're available only in the first week of opening of a new KFC. So if you see a KFC opening in your area, go get one. You get to take it home. Let's check out this video.
Finger licking good. But for your smartphone, it's probably not. That's why we upgraded the ordinary paper tray with a keyboard that is durable, super thin, wireless, and even rechargeable. This is the KFC Tray Typer. Simply power it up and connect your smartphone via Bluetooth. We handed out the Tray Typer in newly opened KFC restaurants so our fans can enjoy our finger licking good food and use their smartphones at the same time. And they did. Geolocated social media discussions skyrocketed, and every single one of the smart paper trays was taken home. The KFC Tray Typer. Finger typing good.
Wow, I want one. I have to admit it. What will they think of next? Well, our TNT fan of the day is Robin Wright in Vacaville, California, actually nearby, who posted this picture on Google+. She's watching last Tuesday's Tech News Today while making a marinade for a chuck roast. She says that she enjoys the show because the hosts and guests are great. Thank you so much for that compliment. We really appreciate it. And if you can see us, we're off in the corner in the background of the meat. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Joe Panettiere, what is happening at After Nines? What are you guys up to?
I think we have something really timely, actually, for our listeners and viewers here on Tech News Today. Anyone who works for a hardware or software company. Now, that's a pretty broad definition, right, Mike?
Yes.
Anyone who's checking out this show, please jump on over to afternines.com/CEO tonight. And we're actually speaking with Justin Crotty over there about how hardware and software companies can do a much better job eliminating something called basically service revenue leakage. There's all this service revenue those hardware and software companies could be making, but they're not. And there's a really easy way to fix that. And Crotty talks about that tonight at 9:01 p.m. Eastern.
It's called service what?
It's called maintenance.net, actually, and service revenue leakage. So, you know,
sounds
you go
embarrassing.
Out, you buy. Absolutely, especially when your profits come in too low and your venture capitalists are mad. That's very embarrassing.
Well, it sounds awesome. I can't wait to listen to that. And of course, you can find Joe Panettiere. You're at Joe Panettiere on Twitter, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Joe Panettiere, all strung together. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Always great to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Deezer. Or if Deezer podcasts aren't available in your country, Spotify. Or you can choose another subscription option at twit.tv/TNT. You can, of course, watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. And if you're ever in town, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. Just send an email to tickets@twit.tv to get tickets. If you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how you can do it. Just post a link to twit.tv/TNT on the social media site of your choice. Tag three friends and recommend that they subscribe. You follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me on Google Plus. Just go to Elgin.com and you'll be redirected to my Google Plus profile. And don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific with guest Molly Brown of GeekWire tonight. And that is the Tech News Today. This show was produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.